the new developments in the Karen Reed murder trial.
This has been a wild turn of events.
I've seen a lot of things. I've never seen anything like this. This case never ceases to amaze me.
It's a spectacle, that's for sure.
It was a hung jury, so no verdict, no real ending to this case.
Karen Reed was back in court where a date was set for her to be tried once again.
There are a lot of issues in this case.
Proctor was improperly searching Karen Reed's cell phone for nude photos.
Michael Proctor, the lead investigator,
relieved of his duties.
It's always the theories that each side will put forth for a jury to decide which one is more believable.
Karen Reed was drunk and angry and hit and killed John O'Keefe when she gunned it in the snowstorm.
Karen, did you ever say I hit him? I hit him.
I did not.
There are more people here at the beginning of this than at the beginning of Johnny Depp's trial.
We're not concerned about any of the witnesses. None of the Commonwealth's witnesses are concerning us.
And once again, there was drama outside court.
There is a whole new set of legal troubles for Karen Reed. She is now facing a wrongful death lawsuit.
The lawsuit alleges that Karen Reed was drunk and reckless when she hit John O'Keefe.
It's not just Reed being sued here. The family also suing the two Canton bars from that night.
The two bars are liable for over-serving her.
The FBI is investigating an investigation of a murder. That never, ever happens.
At this point, multiple jurors have been reaching out to both sides, saying that they are certain Karen Reed is not a killer.
I did not kill John O'Keefe. I've never harmed a hair on John O'Keefe's head.
We're looking at arm injuries with scratches. We're not looking at tire tracks.
There are 17 jurors, and they are coming and going with a police escort.
The investigation wasn't thorough.
This can't be good for the prosecution moving forward.
I just hope justice is served for either one, whatever it is, you know?
The fate of her life is not in her hands anymore. It's not in the hands of her attorneys. It's not in the hands of the prosecutor. It's in the hands of the jury now.
Imagine one morning there's a knock at your door. Officers have come to ask you some questions about an incident they're investigating nearby. You answer the questions, not having anything to hide, and don't think much else about it. Days later, they show back up. You're under arrest for a serious crime that you didn't commit, and you're told that you're going to spend the rest of your life in prison. There's no trial, no defense. They don't want to hear about your alibi. You are presumed guilty regardless of evidence or circumstances. Think about what an unjust world that would be. Luckily, the justice system here isn't built that way. The cornerstone of how the process works is the presumption of innocence. From the first moment that a juror walks into the courtroom, they are to look at the accused as innocent. That is an innocent person sitting at that table. Not just not guilty or maybe, or, well, let me sit here and hear everything against them so that I can hold them accountable. No, that is an innocent person at that table. And they remain innocent until the prosecution presents so much compelling evidence that you are forced to no longer look at them as innocent because there's no other reasonable alternative. That burden of proof lays solely on the prosecution. You want to take someone's freedom? You have to prove that they did what you're accusing them of. And in order to do that, you have to show evidence that eliminates all other possibilities, leaving your accusation as the only reasonable answer. This week, the prosecution wrapped up their case against Karen Reed. They laid out all the evidence and brought in their final witness, an accident reconstructionist and biomechanical engineer named Dr. Judson Welcher. Welcher is the closer. He's the one the prosecution needs to come in and explain to this jury how this SUV could have hit John O'Keefe and caused those injuries, and how the injuries to John O'Keefe could have lined up with the damage to the car. And more importantly, he needs to show that the impact that he's describing is the only reasonable explanation for what happened. So why is all of this falling on him? Well, look at the evidence presented up to this point. It's all shaky with a lot of holes in it. There was testimony that Karen Reed was hysterical. She was asking if she could have hit John O'Keefe with her car. Is that concrete? No, she's frantic and confused and trying to figure out what happened, trying to make sense of it and process possibilities in her head. That doesn't close out all other reasonable explanations. She had a brief fling with Higgins, but she ghosted him. She had been drinking, but so had everyone else. She left John angry voicemails, and that's not something you do when you just killed someone. That's something that you do when your boyfriend is out and you're pissed about it. John's DNA was on the outside part of the taillight, but he was in and around the car that night, so that's not surprising. And it's kind of a moot point since there were also two other DNA profiles found on there, and there was no blood or tissue on the car, just touch DNA. So the DNA evidence isn't really evidence of anything at all. There was a hair that could have belonged to John or his niece or his nephew, but Karen was there at the house with them, and there wasn't even a root or blood on the hair. There's her phone data that shows that she was there dropping John O'Keefe off, but that's not disputed. The medical examiner didn't even have enough to determine that this is a homicide, even knowing all of the information from the investigation. And the brain surgeon testified that the head injury is from a fall, not an impact with the car, so the fall could be from anything, and that doesn't help rule out all other scenarios either. Then there's the taillight, and this is where the whole case changes. Think about it like this. If there were no alternate theories and no issues with the evidence and the investigation and the people involved, if there were no butt dials and butt callbacks, no shady texts, no changing statements from witnesses, if there were no rehoming of dogs and phones and houses, if there were no SIM cards being destroyed at military bases and late-night trips to the police office, if the glass on the bumper matched the glass from the cup, if there were no missing Sallyport videos or non-existent chain of custody, if there were no Solo cups and Stop and Shop bags, if there were no Proctor, if those things didn't exist, the taillight would be a huge key to ruling out all other reasonable possibilities. If you were told that there was taillight found at the scene and in the bag with his clothing debris, and Karen has a broken taillight, that could potentially be the end of it. That could be the evidence that forces you to no longer look at the woman sitting at that table as innocent. But we know that even that evidence is shaky, because all of those issues that I just listed do exist. So what should be the strongest evidence against Karen still doesn't eliminate other things that could have reasonably happened. And that is where Welcher comes in. He has two jobs to wrap this case up for the prosecution. One, to show that the injuries to John O'Keefe came from Karen Reed's car. And two, to rule out anything else being a reasonable possibility. So how did he do? Well, as 13th jurors, I'll let you decide if Welcher's testimony is able to force you into a guilty verdict. Welcher takes a stand after a short voir dire, which we'll get to later, and gives some of his background. He's an accident reconstructionist and biomechanical engineer. He has an extensive background that Brennan spends more than 20 minutes walking through, including a presentation that he did at a convention about the theory of the science and mathematics behind sideswipe or side impact collisions. Now, when he was asked how he got into this field, he had an interesting response.
So when I was getting ready to go to college, my father, who was a physician, said, whatever you do, do not go to medical school. Because I was getting ready to go to medical school. So this was 39 years ago, I believe. 35 years ago. 39 years ago. He said, it's just not worth it. So I said, okay. So then I entered into the mechanical engineering.
Interesting take. Welcher explains what he used for his analysis. He says he starts with a broad range of information, then narrows it down to what he considers the most important stuff. He doesn't rely on everything because sometimes he says it's not reliable, or sometimes it's irrelevant. In this case, he had police reports, video footage, pictures of the scene, lab reports, medical records, the autopsy of John O'Keefe, and he had some other things that weren't scientific. For example, Karen's Dateline interview and 2020 interview, and previous witness testimony. As Welcher is beginning his testimony, I picked up on a few things that I think Brennan is intentionally asking in preparation for ARCA. Dr. Welcher from Aperture is kind of like the opposite of ARCA in some ways. They're both involving crash reconstruction and biomechanical engineering, but have different conclusions. In order for Brennan to be able to exclude all reasonable doubt, he needs the jury to trust Dr. Welcher more than they trust ARCA. One thing that often comes up in crash reconstruction testimony is whether or not it's important that experts actually view the car themselves. It's something Dr. Wolf from ARCA mentioned in his footnotes he did in an email that he sent to attorney Alan Jackson. And Brennan made a big deal about it in a pretrial hearing. Brennan asked Welcher about coming to see the car and the scene firsthand, and Welcher says he did.
In this case, I was able to look at the scene and both vehicles.
Was that an important part of your study, Doctor?
I think so. Again, it's always good if you're going to talk about what happened to the cars or what happened to the people to look at what happened to the cars, meaning to actually look at the cars, not just look at photographs when possible. So I have physically looked at the cars. For example, on the Lexus, I climbed in it, over it, underneath it. I downloaded data from it. I did a whole bunch of things looking at Ms. Reed's Lexus to assist in my analysis to try and add some further objective data to what we're doing here.
ARCA experts explained specifically why inspecting the car in person didn't impact their testing, and they described the training they have in looking at pictures in a specific way to determine proper size perception and things like that. Photogrammetry is a specialized training to be able to do accurate measurements, and you can use those to create 3D models. And Dr. Wolf explained that they were trained in this during the last trial. Interestingly, I found a technical paper written by Welcher himself explaining that photogrammetry is actually as accurate as hands-on measurement, and in some cases, tested even more accurate when it comes to accident reconstruction. Interesting stuff, and it'll be interesting to see the differences in ARCA's testimony versus Dr. Welcher, who the judge says gets to come back and have another go at it once ARCA is done. But aside from laying foundation to differentiate Aperture from ARCA, direct testimony of Dr. Welcher focused on a few main topics. One is the analysis he did to determine if he thinks that Karen Reed could have broken her taillight when she backed out of the garage and hit John O'Keefe's car. Welcher shows a slide on the PowerPoint that has five pictures, kind of in a collage, and tells the jury this is the picture of him, notes his Garmin watch in the picture, and says he is in those pictures looking at the composition and dimensions of Karen's SUV. He also inspected John O'Keefe's car and says he brought them together to compare potential points of impact. Welcher then used the Ring camera videos on John O'Keefe's house, the Ring camera video of Karen backing out of the garage when she hit John O'Keefe's car, and he did some laser scanning to make a 3D model. He took the video frames of Karen's car and where the tire tracks were and lined it up using a grid that was laid over the images of the frames. Welcher said he measured the height of John O'Keefe's car, and he used the measurements from Karen's car that were taken at the Sallyport a few days after John's death. He says he looked at John's car and there was no damage at the spot where the impact would have happened. He said the impact was enough to knock the snow off, and he shows that on the video, but says it wasn't enough to damage John's car. Welcher said he inspected Karen's car where it would have impacted, and he said he saw a scratch. So Welcher gave his opinion on whether or not Karen's taillight broke coming out of the garage and hitting John O'Keefe's car.
That impact did not break or crack that taillight.
Is that your opinion?
That's my opinion.
Is that to a reasonable degree of engineering certainty?
That's to a high degree of engineering certainty.
So the impact between Karen's car and John's car was one topic. Then there was the tech stream data. Welcher looked at the two trigger events that occurred under key cycle 1162. So Toyota uses a tech stream trigger event to initiate the recording of data, rather than recording data continuously. And it will generally record the 5 seconds before and the 5 seconds after whatever it is that calls the trigger. Kind of like an iPhone camera when they do live photos. Pressing the button to take the picture triggers the photo to record a short video instead of it just being a snapshot. There's movement before the moment that the button is pressed and after it with the trigger in the middle. These trigger events cause data to be recorded to allow investigators to focus on specific events or scenarios, like accidents or unusual driving behavior, by isolating the data that surrounded those events. There's no trigger event for when Karen's car hit John O'Keefe's car, or for when the prosecution says it allegedly hit John O'Keefe either, because the trigger events are only for events that could significantly impact the occupant of the Lexus. This became a topic of a little bit of debate here because if the impact of hitting John O'Keefe supposedly shattered the taillight, wouldn't that be significant? But Welcher specifically says we don't know in the Techstream data when he was hit. So the Techstream data also doesn't have any dates or times on it, which means there's nothing on there saying the 1162 key cycle was on January 29th at any point in time. The Techstream data does record mileage, and it has a timer on it that counts seconds from the time that the car is turned on. So Welcher says he used the information from Trooper Paul's work to see the mileage of when they took pictures of Karen's car in the Sallyport. And the mileage that was listed on key cycle 1162, he figured that difference as being around 36 miles. Then he used Google Maps to map out the different places that Karen was known to have gone, and he figured some different routes that she maybe could have taken to try to see if that would add up to nearly 36 miles to make that difference. The number he came up with was around 37.9 miles, so a little off, but they went with it. Welcher said he and Burgess, based on Burgess's new report, determined the first trigger event in the 1162 key cycle was a three-point turn that was made when Karen Reed missed the turn onto Fairview Road and had to turn around. He lined up the timer on the Techstream data with John O'Keefe's phone location data. And Karen Reed had said in an interview they did a three-point turn because she missed the road. So he determined that the first trigger event was at that point. It triggered because the accelerator open ratio exceeded 30% on the gas pedal after putting the car in reverse. The second event happened about 8 minutes later in the data. Welcher says the data for that event shows the wheels slipping, so the tire speed isn't accurate. But he says the car travels forward 34 feet, stops, then reverses 53 feet. The speed at the time of the trigger was 13.67 miles per hour. And the car was at 74% throttle and 23 miles per hour when the data stopped recording. There was no braking, and the trigger was the high throttle opening after the transition into reverse. Welcher said the new report from Burgess helped him line the clock in the car up to the clock on John O'Keefe's phone, putting the variation between 21 to 29 seconds. So he said this new information helped them line it all up and show that the second trigger event is what happened in front of 34 Fairview when Karen reversed. But reversing is one thing. Showing that she hit John O'Keefe with her car is another. We'll be right back after this. One of the biggest issues in the prosecution's case is the injuries to John O'Keefe lining up with the damage to the car. It's hard to understand how a 6,000-pound car can hit a person without causing broken bones and bruising. And it's hard to understand how an arm can hit a taillight hard enough to shatter it, but not do any major damage to the arm other than abrasions. The injuries have always been a problem that the Commonwealth needs to explain. And last year, Trooper Paul left a lot to be desired in that department. Also, we heard from ARCA that the injuries aren't consistent with having been hit by a car. And they were so easy to understand and follow. Plus, ARCA was hired by the feds, an independent third party who did testing and a report. I put a lot of trust in that. So now, it's up to Welcher to change my mind. The first thing Welcher does, which was not something I was a fan of, is to dress exactly like John O'Keefe for this experiment. The same orange shirt, same hoodie, same shoes, and a hat. He was dressed exactly like John O'Keefe while recording a video, first of him kind of running into the car, and then of the car backing into him at 2 miles per hour. I didn't like it. It felt odd to me. Not the experiment, but dressing as the victim. Welcher says he's a similar height as John O'Keefe, so that makes the experiment more valid. Although, they aren't exactly the same height, and some people are longer in the legs or torso than others. Also, some have longer arms. So I'd need more information to know anything for sure. So here's Welcher's experiment. He covers the taillight in blue grease paint. He has someone drive the car backwards towards him while he's holding a cocktail glass out, and his hand is painted yellow where he's holding the glass. But he's not holding it in a normal way. Think about how you hold a glass when you're standing. Bend your arm beside you the way that you would hold one. The natural position is the arm being bent in a way that the cup is kind of close to your body, often with your elbow going back a little bit to balance it. And this is natural. No extra effort exerted to hold it. But the way he holds the cup in the experiment isn't natural. He's holding it with his elbow more forward, kind of like the position that you would have your arm if you're about to shake someone's hand. And that stood out to me. So first he was kind of like just walking into the car, and he does this move like he's trying to twist off to the side. Then he has the car back up at 2 miles per hour, and he does the same thing, but faster. To me, it doesn't look like a natural reaction. It looks intentional. He says the car impact is making his body turn like that, but it doesn't look like that at all to me. So he hits his arm on the taillight and then shows that there's blue paint on his arm. And he says the paint that rubbed off on his arm lines up to around the same area where John's scratches were. He doesn't explain anything about how it could happen or how it could break the taillight or how it could scratch his arm, only that it would have been around the area of his arm. Consistent with the height and orientation if he's standing in that awkward, unnatural position. But that's about it. Then there's the issue of the eye injury. Welcher has the jury look at a slide that shows his eye is around the same area as the spoiler or wind wing that sticks out on the top of the car in the back. So I guess the implication here is that somehow that 6,000-pound car was backing up and hit John O'Keefe in the eye. Although I do remember Maureen Hartnett being asked about damage on there, and she said she didn't see any. There's also a small bruise on John's knee, and it's really small. It was the only bruise on him anywhere other than his arms and his head, and Welcher says that lines up to the bumper. So the impact is enough to bust a taillight, but only a tiny bruise on the knee where the bumper sticks out. Then there's the head injuries. Welcher says that head injuries are the most common with pedestrian impacts, and because there were no mandible or facial fractures, he says that the head injury is from a fall, not an assault. There's also a moment in court where he wants to take out a baseball hat and put it on to demonstrate something, but that's objected to and denied. He says the hat could drag and cause the abrasion on the back of John O'Keefe's head. Now, Welcher did some experiments with a crash test dummy, basically kind of like a fall test to check the height and force for head impacts. And he wasn't at all clear about it for the jury, and he kept rattling off numbers. It was very hard to follow. But the basic idea was that John O'Keefe was tall enough that there would have been enough force to crack his skull when falling back. Of course, that would depend on the surface that he fell on. But also, that kind of leaves a door open for the defense. So Welcher is ready to give his conclusions.
Could you share with the jury what your opinion is to a reasonable degree of engineering certainty about whether the defendant's Lexus struck Mr. O'Keefe on January 29, 2022, around 12:32 a.m.?
Yes, based on the totality of the evidence, DNA, everything I've talked about, that is consistent with that happening. With a reasonable degree of scientific certainty, that is what happened.
Objection, move to strike, Your Honor.
So here's the thing. You can't say that this is what happened because you don't know. And you can't state an opinion as fact. And Judge Cannone knows that this is an issue because she strikes it immediately and asks to see them at sidebar. But as an expert, you're allowed to give your opinion on what you think happened and why, as long as you can back it up. But you can't say that's what happened. And for someone who testifies in trials this often, he probably knows that. Unless he objected and it was struck from the record, there were arguments held outside the presence of the jury on this, and Alessi said the biomechanists are there to answer two questions. Is the damage consistent with pedestrian hitting a car? And are the injuries consistent with being hit by a motor vehicle? The question of whether or not there was a collision at that time where Karen Reed hit John O'Keefe, that is not a proper question. Now, Brennan gets worked up making his argument on why he thinks Welcher should be allowed to say that the defendant hit John O'Keefe with her Lexus in front of Fairview. He says, we don't have to play peekaboo and close our eyes to the reality of the fact that the evidence supports that conclusion. The judge gives her decision the next day, and she says Welcher cannot testify that Karen Reed's car hit John O'Keefe, since the inference is not compelled by any scientific method. but he can testify that the damage to the SUV is consistent with a collision. So that's what he does. But he says it's consistent as long as the car is going more than 8 miles per hour. Y'all, I have no idea where that number came from because it's not in any of the testimony or presentation up to this point. It seems like it's just kind of thrown in there at the end in the conclusions with no explanation. Welcher says the injuries are a quarter panel vault since he vaulted off the side of the car. And direct impacts have much more severe injuries, but he says that this was a clip or a sideswipe, which doesn't have the same force. He also says the absence of lower body brakes isn't weird with a sideswipe because there isn't the same acceleration speed as the object that it hits. There's no momentum transfer. So those are his conclusions and why he reached them. So has my mind changed? Did this remove reasonable doubt? This was, after all, one of my biggest hurdles in that task. The answer here is no, it did not remove reasonable doubts, and here's why. First, Welcher says he doesn't care what the outcome of his testing is here. He says he doesn't have a dog in this fight. But that's not entirely true, is it? He was hired by the Commonwealth for a contract of around $44,000, and then there was an amendment to that contract for $325,000. That's not a dog, that's a kennel. And experts absolutely deserve to get paid for their time. But if he hadn't had the results or answers that Hank wanted, would that amendment have come along? Also, there were some things that Welcher considered that I think skewed what he did some. Things that aren't scientific. And some of the things that are, he discounted as if it just didn't work with what he was doing. Plus, there were changes in reports and changes to the presentation. And when Welcher was asked about it, he even literally said something about changing it to align better with Wiffen's report. Oh, and the newest version of the presentation didn't even get turned over to the defense until Memorial Day at 3, and Welcher was on the stand the next morning, first thing. There were also some holes that Alessi was able to point out during cross. And cross itself, well, that was a circus from the moment it started.
Morning, Dr. Welcher.
Good morning. We haven't been formally introduced. Your whole name?
Robert Alessi, sir.
Robert Alessi. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
This very first interaction between Alessi and Welcher set the tone for the rest of this cross-examination. I'll tell you how I saw it. From the very first moment, Dr. Judson Welcher wanted to be in charge, and it was an ongoing theme throughout the rest of his time up there, causing some tense interactions at times. There was a main theme that Alessi kept throughout the entirety of the cross-examination: confirmation bias, as in looking at the evidence that supports your case and ignoring the evidence that doesn't. Alessi goes through the purpose of scientific method being to look at things objectively, use methodology and analysis, form a hypothesis, and figure out how something could or could not have happened. But the problem is that it seems like there were a lot of times that Welcher would admit that there were so many unknowns, and he would force certain opinions and speculation in there and try to force those opinions as fact. I mean, the title of his slide presentation even said, "Evidence that Reed Lexus hit Mr. O'Keefe." And some of the things he speculates on, the speculation is to try to make the evidence fit together. Like the scratch mark on Karen's car. Welcher says John O'Keefe could have been holding his glass like right here or right here and it would cause that mark. But he has to stand in a really awkward and unnatural position for that to happen. He says so often that there are so many variables we don't know, like how John O'Keefe was standing, or where his weight was shifted, or whether he was in the street or on the grass. But even with all of these variables, he still gives answers as absolutes. And he ends up getting multiple opinions struck because he's stretching outside of his knowledge. And he does it so often that Judge Cannone even reminds the jury what it means to strike something. That's not a good look for an expert. But the biggest sign of confirmation bias came straight from Welcher's mouth himself.
You could have done other tests where the vehicle was going at 20 miles per hour if you used a crash test dummy, correct? You could have done that.
If you used the right crash test dummy, right, and then to set up the test, because generally you only get one or two shots at it, because you damage the car, you have to know everything about the parameters. And so again, pedestrian impacts are so very sensitive to initial angles. If I were to do a test and it was off a tiny, tiny bit and we got some different results, I would be in here having to defend it. Well, your own testing didn't show it. Point is we don't have enough information to be able to conduct that testing.
So he was only willing to conduct the testing that would give him the results he was looking for. Say no more. And that's the difference in ARCA and Aperture, isn't it? ARCA was hired to conduct testing to find out if the injuries to John O'Keefe and the damage to the car are consistent with an impact. Aperture was hired to make the test results show that they could be consistent with each other. It's one more example of Brennan running this prosecution like a defense. So let's look at the main points that Welcher was there to discuss and the holes that Alessi was able to poke. First, the laser scans that Welcher said prove Karen's taillight didn't crack by hitting John's car. Alessi points out some things that would impact the accuracy of this, including the ring cameras being changed since January, although Welcher says he accounted for there to be a difference on that. He didn't measure it, but he eyeballed it. Now, there are also technical features and parameters that Alessi mentioned, but the biggest thing is the suspension of the car. These laser scans and measurements have to be pretty exact in this case. Inches matter. Whether something is off by an inch or two in one direction or the other, or up and down, can make a difference. And it turns out, Welcher didn't know that there was a 5-inch suspension variation on Karen's car. The car lowers 2 inches when it's turned off. That's something we saw Burgess point out in a slide, actually. He was showing the car dropping when it was turned off, and that was how he verified one of the timestamps. The measurements Welcher used were the ones of the car as it was parked in the Sallyport. But it was off at that time, and the car raises 2 inches, and then raises another 3 inches if you're driving more than 20 miles per hour. But those 2 inches that it raises when turned on can make a difference on the point of impact between cars. And without knowing where that point would be with corrected measurements, we can't really rely on that scan or the testing. Now, the issue with the triggers will always just be that there's no date and time, but also Techstream doesn't record impacts. And as far as the injuries, Alessi points out that the report Welcher used that said head injuries are the most common, y'all, it was from 1979. Think about how different cars were in 1979. And that's wild. Alessi asks if Welcher is aware of new reports, because the new reports apparently show that lower extremity injuries are more common. And, of course, John O'Keefe didn't have any of those. The eye injury that Welcher said lines up with the wind wing or spoiler on the car only lines up if John O'Keefe is standing in the road, not on the berm by the side of the road in the grass, which is where we may have expected him to be based on where he was found. The berm is actually 4 inches higher, so the eye injury thing would no longer add up. Alessi asks about the force of the car being enough to break your hand. And Welcher is definitely trying to control the questioning at this point, and there's a struggle to get any answers out of him that are clear or even direct. He does explain that a narrow impact area will cause a fracture easier than if it's distributed. I always think back to my high school classes on this, where we were told to compare laying on one nail as opposed to laying on a bed of nails that are all placed really closely together. Now, Alessi asks if there's any part of the back of the car that would break John O'Keefe's hand if it's hit. And he says, well, maybe the tailpipe or the spoiler, but other than that, he can't really figure any kind of calculation on that without more information. Alessi moves on from the hand to the arm, and when he mentions Welcher's blue paint videos, Welcher seems to get offended at what Alessi refers to it as.
I'll just call it the blue paint exercise. Is that descriptive enough for you to know what I'm talking about?
No, it's not an exercise, it's a test.
Okay, you want to call it a blue paint test?
Sure.
Okay, let's call it a blue paint test.
Alessi is asking questions about some of Welcher's report and some of his testing, and you can tell Welcher still just wants to be in charge of everything.
Was traveling above 20 miles per hour during the period that you allege the SUV made contact with Mr. O'Keefe. Is that correct?
No. Where did you get that from?
Hold on. Okay. The answer is no.
And here's another example.
If you given a horizontal movement of the car, do you agree that it's more likely than not that vertical lacerations would be an inconsistent jury pattern?
I'm trying to help you, but you know, you got to give me more. So
it doesn't get much better from here. I mean, there were all kinds of other issues throughout. Like Welcher kept looking at his laptop and wanting to read from reports. Experts aren't supposed to do that. Alessi calls this out, and Judge Cannone has to ask him multiple times to close it. Now, the reason this isn't usually allowed is because they want to make sure that the expert's testimony and the answers that they're giving are based on his or her own understanding and knowledge of what they're talking about. And they can't guarantee that if the expert is just basically reading from a document. And the disrespect spread to his comments about other witnesses as well, like Dr. Scordibello, who he apparently doesn't trust to do her job.
Regarding her conclusions about whether this was caused by a car accident or not, did you consider that as the basis of your opinion?
No, I wouldn't take a person like that's opinion for that.
What Welcher used from Dr. Scordibello's report was kind of a point of contention, as well as what he used from Trooper Paul's report. And unless he brought up the specific slides and the information that Welcher actually used from Trooper Paul, since, of course, we know that some of those things are wrong, and they want to be able to question him on what information he relied on. One of the main things that he relied on is the mileage. The defense should be able to cross-examine Dr. Welcher on the information that he used, because he got all of that information directly from Trooper Paul's report and folder. But Brennan didn't want it to happen, and he got up and ignored all of the legal arguments that Alessi made on why it should be allowed in, and just kind of threw out some insults and said he doesn't want the defense to be able to use Trooper Paul against them because it was a big win for the defense last year. He actually said that it was a big win for the defense last year. Now, Cannone ruled in Brennan's favor, of course, and the defense is once again denied the opportunity to present a defense. In between all of the heated moments between Welcher and Alessi was able to address a few other issues that he wanted to question Welcher about. One was the glass on the bumper. Now, this was a big one. Remember, Welcher's entire presentation is about how John O'Keefe was holding this glass and got hit by the car with his hand held out, and it broke the glass, so there was glass on the bumper. And Alessi asks Welcher if he's aware that the glass on the bumper didn't match the cocktail glass. And Welcher had no idea. Alessi asks if he's ever seen that report, and he says no. Then he asks Welcher why he didn't ask Tully about it, since he talked to Tully multiple times. And his response is that Tully isn't a glass expert. Overall, I wasn't super impressed with Welcher as an expert. And I have a feeling Brennan may be worried about the jury comparing Welcher to Arca, because he asked him this on redirect.
Did you ever use encrypted apps to secretly hide your communications? Apps like Signal?
No, I don't have any of those.
So the form of the question, ask it differently.
When you were communicating with members of the Norfolk County District Attorney's Office, did you ever use encrypted apps like Signal to communicate?
Objection, Scope, Your Honor. I'm going to allow it.
No, I mean, I don't even know what that is.
That's definitely a dig. And it gives us an idea of where Brennan is going when Arca comes in. He knows he can't argue with their science. So he's going to try to distract the jury with accusations and insinuations. It's been a theme of his, along with his aggression and disrespectful tone. That doesn't play well with some jurors, which is also why I think I didn't care for Welcher that much as an expert witness. He came across to me as more focused on being in charge and being right than he was explaining clearly what the facts are. And it led to a pretty heated exchange at one point where Alessi was furious because Welcher kept trying to cut him off and talk over him, telling him which slide to go to on the presentation. Alessi finally had to tell him, "I'll decide when we change the slides." The prosecution rested after Welcher completed his testimony. But the expert who is supposed to come wrap things up for them, it kind of fell flat to me. His whole attitude just rubbed me the wrong way. And then I came across this particular court document. and I ended up going down a rabbit hole that I never intended. It started with Welcher, it went here, there, and everywhere, and then it came back to Welcher, and it makes me think that my instincts about him were right. We'll be right back after this. So I went down a rabbit hole of car insurance claims and litigation. Basically, there's a huge corruption scandal where Allstate followed a protocol laid out by a corporate consulting firm called McKinsey & Company. And it made profit the number one priority. And part of that was cutting back on insurance claims, including ones that became known as MIST claims. MIST stands for Minor Impact Soft Tissue. These are claims where there may not have been a lot of damage to the car, but there are soft tissue injuries that you can't see that may need medical treatment, like whiplash or herniated discs. Some of them can end up being pretty serious. And in order to keep from having to pay those out, they developed three principles for the insurance companies to follow. Deny, delay, and defend. Deny the claim, then if they fight you, delay it. Draw it out for so long that it's time-consuming and expensive and nobody will want to keep going. And for those that do keep going, defend. You defend it in court. The plaintiffs are often healed up by then because it takes years. So the jury will see someone who looks healthy, and then they'll see a picture of a car that doesn't look too damaged, and then the insurance companies will have lawyers telling the jury and the judge that the person is faking it. And then they win. They don't have to pay. They also began using biomechanists and crash reconstructionists for this process, and they relied on studies that were later proven to be junk science. Like, totally junk science, completely debunked. But this process is actually still going on today. An attorney who had access to the McKinsey slides from a PowerPoint where they basically gave 12 to 14,000 slides laying out all of this greed. Well, he wrote a book detailing it, and a top spinal researcher and doctor actually wrote chapters for the second edition of that book. His name is Dr. Michael Freeman, and he has dedicated his career to helping victims in the insurance company's MIST scheme in hopes that victims being cheated out of valid claims by greedy insurance corporations will someday stop. He's pretty impressive. He has methodology that's been accepted by the U.S. Supreme Court and is well-published, holds 6 degrees from different universities, and he travels the world lecturing on medical topics and, of course, the junk science behind the insurance MIST schemes. Now, I found a lecture that he did where he describes the importance of using proper methodology to get decisions in the courtroom based on facts, not greed. But not everyone loves the good doctor's work, because for every victim's trial attorney that he may help, he has an insurance company's attorney who isn't a fan. One of those in-house law firms for large insurance companies, they actually list themselves as aggressive in style. They even put a page on their website telling people that they did some digging on Dr. Freeman and quote-unquote found gold. The gold that they found was a letter of reprimand from his chiropractic school in the 80s, where he was suspended for a term before getting his diploma. Now, the law firm who posted this encouraged others to pass it around for anyone who may run into him in the courtroom. And I guess it got around, because that's what brings us back to Dr. Welcher. Some of the studies that Dr. Freeman has done were published in 2021 and were using scientific method and testing to debunk some of the studies that are being used in these MIST defenses. They were able to show how some of these studies were scientifically invalid. Welcher was testifying in a trial in California as a biomechanist and crash reconstructionist for an insurance company that had denied a medical claim for a minor impact soft tissue claim. And on cross, he was asked about Dr. Freeman's study and how it determined that the science that Dr. Welcher was using was completely invalid. And Welcher didn't like that. Apparently, he called Freeman and the other researchers a bunch of chiropractors who had no business doing engineering. Now, Dr. Freeman has a 30-page CV. He holds 6 university degrees, including medical doctor, a couple of masters, PhD, plus bachelor's in chiropractic. And even getting suspended for a quarter, he was valedictorian in his chiropractic school. He's a tenured professor, and his 3-step approach to injury causation investigation has been accepted by U.S. courts as an accepted methodology through a 10th Circuit U.S. court decision. He's been a consultant to NASA and the U.S. Congress on biomechanics of injury. And he's dedicated his life and built his career on protecting victims from the unethical and fraudulent practice of insurance companies. But, okay, yeah, a chiropractor has no business doing engineering. The comment reminded me of how dismissive Welcher was to Dr. Scorti Bello. But then it gets worse. Court documents say that Welcher then lied on the stand to discredit Dr. Freeman. The letter from the 80s that the large law firm passed around says that Dr. Freeman, who at the time was just Michael, was suspended for a term. But he didn't have to retake his clinical exam. He had to come back and see 20 patients. Then he could get his diploma. The reason he was suspended, he has explained in multiple court proceedings, since this is the only thing they can really use against him. When Dr. Freeman was just Michael, he was in Oregon. He attended the University of Oregon, and then he went to chiropractic school to be a chiropractor like his father. He was a standout, exceptional in class, but in order to graduate, you had to have a certain number of patients that you had to see in order to fill requirements to get your diploma. The problem was that the clinic didn't have enough patients for each of the interns there to see. It was a common problem back then. So when it was getting close to graduation and you knew there weren't going to be enough patients for you to see to get out in time, the clinic would allow the interns to observe some things done by other clinicians, and then they would put those patients on their list. It was something that everyone did since there were never enough. Now, at this point, Dr. Freeman had already given the valedictorian address at graduation and was basically ready to start his career. Then he got a call the next week. He had to do his exit exam. And when he was asked on his exit interview about his patients, he wouldn't lie. He refused to lie. Even though it was something that was accepted by the clinic, it wasn't accepted at the school. So when he was asked, he said, no, some of those patients that were on his list were actually ones that were basically him taking credit for them because he just observed other clinicians doing it. It wasn't allowed, so he was suspended and then had to come back, see 20 patients, and then get his diploma. So these court documents basically say that the attorney is asking for a new trial for his client because he says that the most dramatic event at trial came when Dr. Welcher was asked on the stand about the article that was written by Dr. Freeman criticizing his methodology. It states that Dr. Welcher's testimony was perjury. It says that Welcher made demonstrably false claims on the authors of the article, and that Welcher claimed that the author of the article had been kicked out of school for fraudulently misrepresenting his credentials. Well, of course, that's not true. He wasn't kicked out of school, he was suspended, and he didn't fraudulently misrepresent credentials. So the attorney was furious because Welcher is making it look to the jury like this doctor who had just proven that his methodology and science was junk wasn't credible. And the attorney had some harsh words. The documents actually say, quote, "It is laid bare who the fraud is," end quote. And look, all experts will have methodology questioned at some point. And there will always be experts that have different cases where their expert opinion wasn't allowed in for some reason or the other. I don't take that stuff too seriously because I've seen experts that I thought were fantastic and their opinions weren't allowed in. So I don't really go by that. But when there's a study that's published and circulated everywhere that explains exactly why and how they determined that the science that you're using is junk science, that I do take seriously. And you pair that with what appears to be lying about a doctor's history while under oath because His study determined that your science is invalid. And the invalid science is being used to deny medical care all over the country so that these insurance companies can keep profiting, which, by the way, is working. They profited $169 billion last year, and that's just profit. I don't know. It makes me question everything that Welcher said on the stand, especially since I was already kind of questioning some of it anyway. But the prosecution has rested, Welcher is done, and now it's the defense's turn to present their case. And y'all, it is already off to an explosive start. Next week. My name is Brandi Churchwell, creator of 13th Juror Podcast. If you're enjoying it, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and share this episode with your friends. For more information, photos, and episode guides, visit our website at 13thjurorpodcast.com.